Nobody in their wildest dream ever thought that anything was ever going to happen. We had more fear of the fans doing something to one of us than another wrestler.
And welcome back. It's Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, the podcast from the Hitvice TV series where we plunge into the Dark Side archives to uncover real revelations from some of pro wrestling's most storied characters, which have until now never been broadcast. I'm Jack Encarnacio from the Lapsed Fan Wrestling Podcast, joined by my Lapsed Fan co-host JP Sorrow, as well as Dark Side of the Ring's executive producer, co-creator Evan Husney, and also joining us is his fellow Dark Side co-creator, Jason Eisner. Folks, Dark Side of the Ring continues Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern, Vice TV. The subject of this week's episode, The Gentleman Chris Adams. We're talking tonight on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard about Tony Atlas, who of course sat for Dark Side cameras to discuss the tragic 1988 killing of Bruiser Brody in Puerto Rico, and of course a contemporary of Brody's and Tony Atlas's in the world-class territory, as well as just, you know, timetables of when they thrived in the business, was Chris Adams, who unfortunately met a similar demise. He was also killed in an altercation. Before we jump in to what Tony Atlas shared with you guys in a very storied series of sessions to kick off the whole concept, really, of Dark Side of the Ring, Evan, I hope you could tell us a little bit more about Chris Adams and what we can expect next week.
That's right. Yeah, it is also apropos that we are pairing Tony Atlas with the Chris Adams episode in a way, because our very first season, you know, the Bruiser Brody episode, Tony Atlas, was part of season one. And in season one, we did three different stories centered around world-class championship wrestling. There was the Bruiser Brody story, there was the Von Erichs, and there was the episode about gorgeous Gino Hernandez. And that was sort of our world-class trilogy, is what Jason and I called it for season one. And we always wanted to kind of, you know, put a bow on that in some future season by covering the story of Chris Adams. It's always been this one episode we've always wanted to do. And we finally got around to it here for season five. And we were able to get in touch with his family, close friends, you know, fellow wrestlers. And it is a, you know, it's a dark story about a very troubled person who everyone seemingly describes as having sort of a Jekyll and Hyde persona. You know, when he wasn't drinking, he was the best of guys. And when he was a nightmare. And we sort of get into that and we examine that. Also, you know, an amazing career in world class and in himself. He was in a tag team with Gino Hernandez, the dynamic duo. And he also pretty much invented the super kick. You know, that was his finish, Chris Adams. And, you know, that's something you see 850 times in a match now. And so you can trace all the way back to Chris Adams. And and he met his untimely demise in one of the darkest and most disturbing ways. But I won't spoil it, of course, for the episode. Gentleman Chris Adams. Also, he trained Stone Cold Steve Austin, so that we might not have, you know, Stone Cold Steve Austin without Chris Adams. So very fascinating subject, riveting story. Check it out on Tuesday.
Yeah, an Englishman who really just completely allowed himself to be recharacterized as a Dallas wrestling guy, you know, a guy who just became a Texan in a lot of ways and met his demise as well there. So it is a fascinating story and very much looking forward to seeing how you guys present the treatment of it. And we're here to talk about Tony Atlas. And I know just from talking to you guys that this was a very important and significant interview for you guys. When you think back on what Dark Side was in its kind of formative stages and what it became, tell us about sitting with Tony Atlas and the sort of context or the bites we're about to share with people.
This was the very first interview we ever shot for Dark Side of the Ring. This was, the very first story we ever produced was for the killing of Bruiser Brody, which was our pilot episode, proof of concept for the series. And we filmed it in 2017. And, you know, to make a television series, to sort of develop it, to pitch it, you know, all the way into production, it takes a long time. You know, all these things take time. And so there was a lot of buildup that Jason and I had. I think up until this point, we were absolute experts on the subject of Bruiser Brody. We had read every book. We had researched every article. We had looked at every video there was on the internet and beyond, you know, tapes and so on and so forth, familiarizing ourselves with him, his story. And we knew this was the story we wanted to cover first. We were the most passionate about it. We were kind of even not even thinking about how this would sort of grow into an entire series. We were just simply focused on making one documentary about Bruiser Brody at the time. And so when we got to this point, there was so much buildup for what is the show going to be like? What's it going to be like interviewing wrestlers? We had no real experience with wrestlers. We knew they were going to be intense interviews and they were going to be passionate interviews. And, you know, we were looking forward to seeing how it was going to be like with wrestlers looking directly into the camera lens and talking to you, at home about all these firsthand stories. So there was a lot riding on that. And, you know, we didn't have a ton of money. It was a very low budget production, that first pilot. And here we are. We show up. You know, we've been talking to Tony for months, keeping him sort of, you know, we're all kind of treading water, just waiting for that green light to happen. And so we kept him on the line. Everybody else was on the line, you know, waiting for this thing to actually finally happen, probably about a year and a half to 2 years before that. And so then we finally show up at his house in Maine, and we get there, and, you know, he's super nice and his wife is super nice. They live in like a duplex, separate units, which at first was kind of like, okay, you know, whatever. He lives in the top unit. She lives in the bottom unit. And, you know, they've been together for a very long time. And, you know, like I said, super nice, super warm to us. And when we started setting up and we started getting ready for the interview, it was, well, Jason, I'll let you take it from here. Because what I remember is that immediately, you know, the storm. I'm not going to spoil where this goes, but it was like Murphy's Law.
Yeah.
It was about to rear its head here pretty aggressively.
Yeah. And like Evan said, there was a lot of pressure. There was a lot of skeptics too, who thought like what we were doing was kind of crazy and didn't quite get it. And so we just felt we had a lot to prove, and there was like so much riding on this. And this being our first like interview with a wrestler and not knowing quite what to expect. And I remember like when we got there and we're up in his upstairs apartment. His apartment is like filled with like wrestling, you know, memorabilia and a lot of photographs like from his past. And I think like we're like setting up and we get like a little bit like, you know, into like an interview, and like a rainstorm and thunder and lightning starts and like all our sound equipment, because we couldn't even at that point afford someone to do sound. We were just like doing it. It was you, me, and another camera operator. And so we were like, what do we do? Like the sound is like freaking out. And, so we had to put a pause on it.
For whatever, we're getting interference in the, you know, using the little lavalier mics. And so we couldn't quite diagnose the issue, but we knew we had to stop because we didn't want to. We knew this interview was going to be intense. We knew it was going to be, you know, him reliving this very tragic story of seeing, you know, a friend of his in the business being killed in front of him, you know, essentially. And so, I made this call where it's like, I knew we had a travel day the next day, and we had just filmed all this stuff with him that morning of him in the gym, right, working out that you see in the show. And it was like, we were having technical problems. I didn't want to risk anything going wrong. So I said, hey, let's just like take the rest of the day off and we'll come back tomorrow morning early and we'll shoot the interview. The weather will be cleared by then. No stress, everybody.
Yeah.
Let's just do that.
And do you remember in the meantime, like we did spend some time like going through his photographs, and then he took us into his bedroom and he like wanted to show us these like videos. And we're thinking like they're going to be like these really like some cool wrestling, you know, matches or something. And he just like plays this video of himself like laying on the floor and the boot of this woman just stomping on his head like 30 times a stomp, and he's counting it out and he's so excited. He's like, giving like the commentary as if it was a wrestling match. And then she just starts punching him in the face, just like over and over. He's counting it, like doing like a 10 count on it. And like, we're just like,
well, listeners probably don't know that that's his fetish. He's been very open about it.
Yeah. I don't know what was going on, but I do remember like peeking around the corner and he was showing you or someone these videos, and it's just, he was staring at the TV screaming 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, counting out the face stomps. And so that was unique, you know. That was just the beginning, because what happened was the next morning we returned to film the interview, and we started early, and all of a sudden it's got to be a 3 to 4 hour interview. It's a long interview. Yeah. And we covered, you know, his career, the Brody incident and everything. And I'm sitting there, you know, with the questions and talking to him, and he's just on fire, like so impassioned, so much emotion, definitely triggered by the, you know, traumatic memories of that day when Brody died and all of that stuff. And so it was just really intense. But like, as a filmmaker, you're watching this, and you're like, this is going to be extremely captivating television. And then 3 hours, 4 hours later, cut. And Jason, you can take
it. Oh my God. Yeah. Like at some point in the process, we like had like switched like a card out on the camera, and it's supposed to like continue like rolling onto the next card. I went to go press like stop recording. It just wouldn't stop. Like the light wouldn't come off. And we're like, what is going on here? And then when we investigated more, we basically realized that the A camera didn't record the interview.
Nothing.
And it was so intense. And from what I remember, because it was very traumatic for us too, like I just remember, like we kind of kept it to ourselves a little bit.
You know, the whole point of us shooting the way we do with the wrestlers looking into the camera lens, the intensity of that, like we weren't going to have that now because all that was gone. We just had the side angle. Sure, we still have that, but it's not the essence of what we were looking to prove to everyone with what we've been pitching for the last 2 years. So I crumbled. I broke inside where I was like, oh my God, I'm dead. You know, I don't know. This is it. Like all that I've been hoping and dreaming for with this is dead on arrival. So I just went outside and laid in the middle of the goddamn street. That's what I remember like a snow angel.
Yeah.
In the middle of the street, just looking up, cars going by, like looking up at the sky. And Jason, like a good sort of, you know, to have somebody in your corner like this, because you need this, you know, when you're going through moments like this in production, because shit like this can happen all the time. And you know, being more experienced in being in the trenches with, you know, feature film, you know, snafus and everything at that time, coming to me and basically being like, we can't leave here without this interview. Like, we got to rally. We have to fight and we have to rally. We got to get back up there and we got to go in there. We got to capture this interview somehow, you know? And I'm just like, not knowing exactly how I'm going to rally and how I'm going to do that. But long story short, because I know we got to get to the show, I went upstairs and I'm sitting on the edge of his bed and I'm telling him that we didn't get it, you know, which was very hard to convey, and that we got to do it again. And now this really is the third time we would have to do it, you know, because the first time we started and then stopped. This time we completed, didn't work. We got to do it again. And so finally we got to a place where we found purpose in doing it one last time. Like, we got to do it for Brody's family. We can't forget about Brody and Barbara and Brody and his family and the whole thing. This is why we're doing this. We can't forget about that. We have to do it. And he's like, you're right. And then he was telling me like, oh, you know, Vince would have them, you know, until 3 a.m. doing promos 800 times, you know? So this was no different, you know? And I was like, all right. So then, you know, we got food, you know, we got relaxed because we're going to do this. We're going to be up all night now doing this interview again. And I noticed that, you know, he was triggered, you know, he was still dealing with the trauma of reliving this from just a few hours ago. So maybe it wasn't the best idea to do this, but at the time we didn't know if we'd ever get a chance to do it because, you know, we have no money to come back and to, you know, travel. So we sit down for the interview. Now, flashback real quick, Jason, when we first arrived at his house, he had a little pleather couch that was in the corner of his apartment that he cautioned us, do not sit on or bump into because it's actively peeling. Okay. This pleather couch was peeling because
he had like a wrestler friend stay there for like a month, and the guy just like sweated it out on this couch, and it just like deteriorated the pleather, and so all the little yellow foam was like coming out of it.
The couch is disintegrating in real time, and don't bump the couch was like the only caveat that Tony had for us being in his home.
Yeah. Okay. And there's like a loaded shotgun above the couch too.
So anyway, okay, no problem. We'll watch the couch. Now flash forward to where I was before. We set everything up. It's probably like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock PM. It's getting late, setting it all up. We're going to have to do another 4 hour interview. Here we go. And right as we are just about to roll, Jason, what happens?
Yeah, he like looks over at the couch, and just from the nature of us being in this tight room and stuff, some of that white foam was like coming out of it. And he like took one look at it and he was like, "What the fuck did you do to my couch?"
Oh no.
And we're like, "Oh, sorry. Like, you know, we'll take care of it." He's like, "What the fuck did you do to my couch?" Like,
what are you doing? Like that. And then, you know, Tony, I love you. I love you, but it's been long enough now, we can tell the story. So he flips out, rips stuff apart, and runs downstairs to his wife's unit downstairs. And all I can hear, because he's still got the lav mic on, I can hear through my headphones that unit is being thrashed, and there's things are being broken and smashed. And I'm just sitting there again. If I was dead before, now I'm extremely dead, you know, because like, what the fuck is happening? So I run after Tony and I'm just like, "Tony, it's not a big deal. We'll go fucking couch shopping after this." You know, like, I'm just like, "I'll buy you a $10,000 couch," you know, whatever. Like, it doesn't matter, you know,
It's not good enough for him.
What's that?
I said, it's not good enough for him. He wants that couch.
It had nothing to obviously do with the couch. He was just so traumatized again by the story. So I'm running down there, running after him, and he basically takes one look at me running across there, and I can just tell that if I intervened, because he was actively shadow boxing at this moment.
Yeah. Like, he was like, I feel like ready to take, like, he was like going to take swings at you.
And he was.
You like ready to dodge it.
I was. And so then I realized, okay, this is a little more serious than I thought. And then I went upstairs shortly thereafter. His wife came upstairs and basically delivered us the news. "Tony would like you to leave." And that was it. And essentially, we had to leave without getting the fucking interview. And so that's how this show started. That was the note that Dark Side of the Ring began. Of course, we were able to... we were able to reconnect with Tony, and he did apologize, and he explained that this was something that has happened in his life many times, and it had a lot to do with the fact that, you know, he was so, all of this that was happening because of telling this story. And so we made up, and I think it actually worked for the better, obviously, because we were able to interview him a second time when he was performing up in Buffalo, and he was wrestling, which I didn't even know he still was. So we were able to actually get B-roll of him wrestling, and he was in a better headspace. We were in a better headspace. You know, yes, maybe it took a year or two off my life, but we got it, you know.
So I remember, too, like, another little detail about it was that, like, we had commissioned him to draw a picture of Bruiser Brody because that part of the story, he was in the locker room when Bruiser Brody was killed. He was drawing a picture of Brody's son. His artwork is incredible, so amazing. And so we thought it would be cool to like show him in the episode drawing this Bruiser Brody picture. And he had finished like half of it.
We were going to film him finishing the other half. Yeah.
Yeah. And so before we left, like, we packed everything up, and Evan, you like took out some cash and you put it on the picture. Like,
well, I was going to buy it. I was going to buy it to have it for myself, which I do. It's hanging above me right now, and I wanted it, so it wasn't going to be like something the show was going to pay for. I wanted to pay for it. And he later told me when we reconnected that, like, that's what, you know, made him realize what he had done, you know, and how sorry he felt about the whole situation was seeing the money there paid for a fully drawn drawing, you know. And but then, of course, for me, it's like, okay, now I know we can do business now, you know?
That's absolutely unbelievable. What a story. Just to be clear, though, I mean, the sound that we have, there is just a tad bit of distortion in some of the clips. The sound survived, but what you're saying is the video did not.
There was two cameras. So the A camera, where he's looking, you know, directly into the viewer, that angle did not survive of the first interview. The second angle, the side camera angle, existed.
As well, but, as
you
the
know,
sound.
We're such yeah. As well as the sound. Yeah.
And we put some of that in the episode.
We did
in there.
Okay.
Yeah, we did.
That's fascinating stuff. So, all right, we got to reset. Bruiser Brody, everyone knows the story, and we're going to talk a lot about Tony Atlas, the man, and how he became a wrestler and how he came up in the world. That's one of the things we try to do on Unheard is look through these transcripts, not just to revisit the story the episode told, but, you know, a little color that might not have fit in there that they gave us about where they came from and how they came up as wrestlers. But JP, I just want to turn to you quickly. We've talked endlessly over the years about this incident in 1988. It's a haunting incident. And just tell the people.
The first time that I really dug into it for the first time, it was when we were in college, and you'd gotten me the book, the Meltzer tributes book. And, you know, I was up late and I'm reading about Bruiser Brody's death. And I'm in a weird place mentally at this point because it's so late and I've been up for, you know, like 22 hours or whatever. And so my mind goes to the weirdest places, like, oh my God, this is what one of my roommates is going to do to me right now. I just went crazy in my mind because I was so overtaken by this story. And I would just come up with complete lunacy of these bizarre paranoia that hit me at 4 a.m.
JP, you see Tony Atlas, you know, shine through in a lot of ways in this episode with his retelling. Not only is he a witness, he is kind of the hero of the story, stepping forward when others wouldn't to help get Brody medical attention. What did you think about how Tony Atlas told this side of the story?
It doesn't always come across with especially wrestlers of that era, to see this like real human concern and this like, yeah, you know what? Like, this is your friend who's you know, been stabbed. And the whole thing about him going into the ambulance and going to the hospital with him, I mean, it's just it's heart-wrenching. It's heart-wrenching. I can't imagine having to be in a situation like that where you're taking your friend to their deathbed. I mean, I don't know if he knew it was his deathbed or not, but to do that, it's ugh.
There's a line in the episode from I think it's what Mick Foley says in his narration, which, you know, he was supposed to be the original narrator for the show, which is kind of interesting in and of itself, you know, and there's so much for the story that resonated so personally with him too, being such a fan of Bruiser Brody. But I think there's a line that he says something about, like, you know, in a business, a callous business like this, where, you know, you don't have friends and it's everybody's in it for themselves, like, you know, Tony was that friend for Brody that night.
That's what adds so much gravity to it, is that there's this pall cast over the scene where nobody else is willing to help Brody, because it's a situation where no one wants to get involved in this foreign land with this, you know, different language being spoken, a different sort of fraternity around you if you're not a Puerto Rican wrestler, which many in the locker room weren't that night. Just a story that allows Tony Atlas's character to shine through, I think, is what it comes down to. And so how did Tony Atlas come to be that guy that stepped up for Brody? It started in Lowmore, Virginia, which is a tiny town on the border with West Virginia, where Tony Atlas was born and raised. He talked to you guys about his upbringing in a small town and how his mother raised 9 kids all by herself. His father left when he was 2, and talked a lot about the time it took his mother to work and come home for the day and just setting out instructions for her kids so they could all cook for themselves on a piece of paper because she wasn't going to be home to prepare dinner, and just great illustration of the poor upbringing he had and how he learned to do so much with his bare hands. And when it came time to deal with bullies or just, you know, boyhood squabbles in the neighborhood, he recalled to you guys one day his mom came home and she could tell that something was bothering Tony, that he had been into a fight. And what does she do? She says, we're going to the park where this kid is. And what happened next led to Tony Atlas not only having a life-forming experience, but also a nickname and a reputation for fighting.
She looked at me and said, get him. I go, Mom, he just beat me up. She said, do what I say, boy, get him. So I went, he beat the hell out of me again. So my mother said, that was good. Now tomorrow I want you to do it over again. And he said, every time you see him, I want you to jump on him. So I did what my mom said. Every day I jumped on him. Every day he beat the crap out of me. Finally, one day I went to fight him. He saw me coming, and he said, oh, you win today, Tony. Then nobody want to fight me because I got that personality. If you fight me today, you got to do it again tomorrow. And I'm going to keep fighting you until I win. I just won't stop. So I had a nickname when I was a kid. It was Argo. Because whenever there was a fight, somebody said, anybody want to go fight? I'll go. I just volunteered for everything. They called me. What I wanted to say was I go, but my English wasn't that good, so I said I'll go instead of I go. And believe it or not, in 1982, I got in a fight with Saito, who was Mr. Fuji's partner. He was a ninth degree black belt in judo and karate, a real rugged guy. Me and him got in a fight. And I did the same thing with Mr. Saito that I did with Urshan Godfrey. I fought him every day. Finally, Vince McMahon Sr. said, Tony, if you fight one more time in this dressing room, I'm going to fire you. So I always been that away.
I thought back to what you said there, Evan, about him exploding in anger during that moment in the interview. This is a guy who, he's so charming, he's so personable, he sparkles almost when he tells stories, but short fuse.
There's a story where he talked about how, like, you know, his childhood, a lot of his anger issues came from there, and that he talked about how, like, back in the day when wrestlers were getting paid in cash, that they would carry guns with them, and then he had a gun that had like a six-inch barrel on it.
Dirty Harry gun. Yeah.
Yeah, and one time in the locker room, he talked about how like wrestlers would just sometimes be hanging out in the locker room like butt naked, and Andre the Giant would like do that. He'd be sitting there playing cards with his boots laced up, and he would just be butt naked. And then he like got angry for some reason, and he took out his gun and he started firing it into the ceiling, and everyone like ran out of the locker room, and Vince McMahon was walking, I guess, down the hall with Cyndi Lauper just as Andre came out like butt naked. Cyndi Lauper was like right there.
And they had to call Atlas's bunny, SD Jones, Special Delivery Jones, to come pick him up because nobody else could kind of calm him down. But that was like the only guy, yeah.
We definitely saw that side for sure.
So he breaks into the business and he's learning, Tony Atlas is, the importance of illusion, which of course any wrestler of his vintage has to, including how to get color, how to bleed in the ring, how to use a razor blade to draw the blood for the dramatic effect, and in some interesting connectivity to where he's headed in terms of the Puerto Rican wrestling scene, a legend of that scene, Abdullah the Butcher, was the wrestler that Tony Atlas was sharing the ring with here, as he tells you guys, when he learned the art of blading.
The first time it happened to me, I didn't even know it happened. You don't feel it when it happened to you. And then all of a sudden, the whole world turned red. The first time I wrestled Abdullah, he got me down and sliced my head. I go, I didn't hardly feel it. It's a razor blade. You just feel a little sting, like a burn, burning feeling. And then the blood just started coming. I said, oh, what the fuck? Where'd that come from? Relax, kid. We're getting the juice. Hit me again. I said, this man slicing my with a freaking razor blade. You know, scared the hell out of me. So then I come back, hey, kid, great, fantastic. You got some good juice, kid. The people love it. People came to see the blood.
We were really, I remember, Jason, you know, we were really fixated and into those types of details of like the idea of trying to get in all the early interviews we did, trying to get as much detail into, you know, that process. Cause we knew that we wanted this show to appeal to non-wrestling fans. We wanted like general audiences to be, you know, horrified and intrigued by all of this. And anytime you can get someone to break down the process of what these guys would do night in and night out, especially back then, it's just, it's hard to even wrap your head around.
Yeah. And wasn't it just even like a few days later after the Tony thing that we were with Abdullah the Butcher?
Yes.
As well too. Yes. And that was like a whole other crazy experience where we learned what it was like to get worked.
Season two of Dark Side Unheard, we're definitely going to do some Abby for sure.
That'd be great. Yeah.
Oh, we will. Don't worry. That.
So that's part of the magic, right, is learning how to draw that blood. And as Tony Atlas, who I found, looking through the transcripts and stuff, to be very eloquent in describing the art of the illusion in wrestling, he really phrased it beautifully as he talked about, you know, what was most important as he broke in the 70s to keep forefront in your mind as you're a pro wrestler, to keep the fans coming back and keep the fans believing, and how important that line between fans believing and not believing is to straddle. And here he tells a story about how blading, as he just, you know, sort of talked about, what was key to being able to keep the myth alive when you encountered fans outside of the arena afterwards with a big old white bandage on your forehead from when you were bleeding.
Our job was to convince the world that it was not fake. But people got their own belief system. So they wrestle between fantasy and reality. And that's the drawing power of wrestling. Because even if they go in thinking one thing, now they're confused because they got their thoughts and then they got their experience. So they common sense is wrestling with their experience. Because they see stuff that they don't believe in, but then they see something they believe in. So you got believability and disbelief all working simultaneously. And that's the drawing power of wrestling, because the person can never figure out, is it or isn't it? Is it or isn't it? And so people keep coming out of curiosity. So in the 70s and 80s, what drew people to wrestling was curiosity. Today is entertainment. My day, curiosity. Because you got one belief, but then all of a sudden you see a guy get busted open. So you wait in the parking lot for this wrestler to walk to the car. Then you look at him, and he got this big patch on the head and say, hey, did he really hurt you? The wrestler would pull the patch off, and the guy see the cut on his head. Oh, man, that's real.
We talked a lot about when we were putting the show together, this specific, you know, pilot and the whole series. We were very fixated on that sort of phenomenon right there. The idea of being in that blending of reality and fantasy and how that very specifically relates to the Bruiser Brody story of his death and how you find traces of the sort of scripted, manipulated world of wrestling influencing how something like this, you know, a very real story unfolds. And yeah, I mean, he's an amazing speaker. He's an incredible interview. He always broke down things like that, that anybody can understand that. And it dawned on me too, just now listening to that and being like, yeah, that's a great way to say that, is that even after all the craziness we experienced with Tony in trying to capture the interview, I remember when he called me after finally watching this episode, which wasn't, I think it was, Jason, was it 2 years later or a year and a half later?
It would have been, yeah.
Because we had to, you know, of course we made the pilot, then we made the full season one and we finished the Brody episode a little, we added more to it, you know, after we shot the pilot. And so seeing that, you know, he loved it after we had finished it and shown him, he had loved the episode. And it was kind of this amazing moment of like all of us had gone through that crazy traumatic thing and got on the other side of it together and can celebrate this thing that we did make together. He's so good in this episode. And he is also good in the Abdul episode from season four. He's very good.
And so acquainted with that illusion that, like you said, it's almost like folks in the business were ill-equipped to process what was happening in front of their eyes when Brody was killed in that locker room and when they heard about it afterwards, because it was, there was no angle to it. There was no way to no sell it. You know, it was just, it was as real as it could be. And it was almost too visceral for some of these guys, save Tony Atlas, who, as so well depicted in the episode, steps forward. And it was such a stark contrast to have something of such brutality happen. When the guys were on a tour of Puerto Rico, a lot of wrestlers talk about how they never went back to the island to wrestle after this happened, just out of, you know, a general sense of distaste for how it was all handled and just a sense of, you know, fear for themselves of what could happen if they crossed the wrong person backstage, whatever the case may be. And it stood in such stark contrast, as Tony Atlas told you guys, to how the boys regarded Puerto Rico before Bruiser Brody's murder.
The boys said going to Puerto Rico like having a paid vacation. I mean, the houses was big. They were drawing money like crazy. They're bringing all these American wrestlers. You know, everything was good. We was eating paella, eating lobsters, eating steak. I mean, going out to the club, we were treated like king. We were staying in the best hotel. We were spending the whole day on a... My day in Puerto Rico before that incident was getting up in the morning, having breakfast, going to the gym, getting a workout, come back and have lunch and lay on the beach all freaking day. And then drive to the matches and getting food, stopping these little sidewalk vendors and getting food and stuff on the way, drinking beer, coming back, grabbing a couple of Puerto Rican girls, going up the room, smoking weed and getting laid all night. That was the whole week. Nobody in their wildest dream ever thought that anything was ever going to happen. We had more fear of the fans doing something to one of us than another wrestler. Thinking of another wrestler doing something to us never crossed any of our minds. We all had a fear of the fans, because the fans in Puerto Rico was wilder than any fans you could ever see anywhere in the world. I mean, they took this literally. And they supported their heroes like literally, they would die for Carlos Colon, these fans. And they would do anything to hurt. I mean, a lot of guys got shot at. They got knives pulled on them. People throw rocks at you. They throw piss on you. They throw feces on you. I mean, they was the wildest crowd you ever want to see in your life.
We've watched some Puerto Rico over the years, JP, on the Lapsed Fan, including Terry Funk, you know, just tearing ass through that place. And, you know, you see like riot cops in the audience with batons, and you just get the sense that at any moment, like everyone could just decide to just hop the fence. Like they had these big baseball stadiums they would run shows in with just so much room between the fans and the ring. And it just seems so, I don't know, it just seems so much more tense.
I agree. I mean, it feels like it's just completely unsafe to be a fan, let alone a wrestler. Like I'd be horrified to be a fan watching this stuff. Like it's so intense. Like, you know, it's just, it's wild. And I'm okay not ever going ever.
When you see that footage and Jason and I, you know, we collected a lot of the archive, and I remember watching it, and there's a sense of danger about everything. And we were just, our jaws would be on the floor watching some of this stuff. When they light the ropes on fire is insane. Or my favorite clip ever, which no one should watch because it's very disturbing, is when they intentionally filled a guy's stomach with like pig's blood or something.
Yeah.
You know what I'm talking about?
Yes.
And then like someone dives on him in the match, and then he starts puking up all of this real blood, like in the ring.
It's like shooting up out like a fountain. It's just like this continuous spray.
That's Puerto Rico, man. They tested all those limits before, you know, ECW, before the Japanese deathmatch scene. That's where the Ring of Fire came from, and using barbed wire that way. Absolutely. So that's kind of the backdrop here. And as we know, you know, we never thought something would happen like this, but it very much did. And on the day of Bruiser Brody's killing, Tony Atlas noticed that Brody was getting waiting at the hotel to get picked up to be taken to the arena by who would become his assailant. Invader number one was the wrestler's name, Jose Gonzalez, who was shuttling Brody all around the island and would do that every time he came out there. But yet he wouldn't pick him up this afternoon, which was very strange to Tony Atlas. And looking back, when he, you know, tries to triangulate why that would have been, why Brody on this particular day would not have been picked up in a timely fashion from the hotel, as he told you guys, there's only one conclusion that he can draw from that.
Why would Jose, the booker, leave his main eventer? Brody was the main event for that match that night. He was the biggest star there that night. He was bigger than me. He was the bigger, him and Abdul were the two biggest stars that night. So why would Jose pick him up every day of the week? I think they was going to do it at the hotel. And Brody popped up at the matches. That's why they left him. They probably, some people, they probably was going to come to the hotel and get him. They would let him, because most of the guys, if you don't wrestle tonight, what most of the rats are going to do? They're going to smoke weed and get drunk. They probably had planned to get him later. They didn't want him at the match. That's why they didn't pick him up.
As you guys get across so clearly in the episode, there was a sense when Bruiser Brody walked into the locker room that night for the matches, that there was a sense that there was a surprise that he was there, almost like a, what is he doing here, from the circle that Jose Gonzalez was part of.
Yeah, I'm definitely recalling all of that. And I'm also recalling things that I learned and heard after the episode aired. Because there were a few details that came up from other people we talked to along the way, you know, well after this was finished, of this idea of, you know, it's like second, third hand information. So, you know, prefacing that, it's not direct. But a lot of people had heard stories about the night before in question. Brody was very adamant about getting this payoff, that he wasn't getting paid. He was owed a ton of money, you know, tens of thousands of dollars, something like that. And he basically went in, David Manning in the episode from World Class does mention, you know, I'm going to go there, I'm going to get my money. He mentioned that. And I guess what happened is that, you know, Brody just went straight to Jose the day before and basically slapped him silly and humiliated him in front of his, you know, subordinates or whomever. And it was ugly and it was really bad. So there was a confrontation of some kind the night before. That's what we had heard, again, like third hand. And that does kind of track, you know, with this idea of, you know, why he's not picking him up and, you know, all this other thing and the surprise of seeing him, you know, and he was known for not taking any shit. And he was known for if there was any issues with promoters or if there was any issues with payment specifically, that, you know, he was going to get physical if he needed to, or, you know, hold up people for money or whatnot. And in this instance, he decided to, from what we heard, he decided to specifically target Jose. Obviously, Jose's not the one in charge of that, or the person that really, you know, whose money it is. It was Carlos Colon's. But that's what the story was.
Fascinating. Yeah, and you guys also talk in the episode, and Tony talks to you about that incident where Jose Gonzalez was working for the WWF at a time when Brody was there and coming through, and there was an incident where Brody lumped him up pretty good during a match, and how that served as sort of like a history between the two, and you know, Gonzalez making comments that he was going to harm Brody one day. Some of these tales may very well be apocryphal. They may be sort of, you know, adjusting the past to fit what ended up happening. That's always a necessary preface with these things. Wrestlers' memories are not only bad, they're actually just, they have a bias towards the false. But it's Tony's truth. And I'll tell you, he's not afraid to say it. And there are a lot of people that know about what happened here that are afraid to say some things. So we work with what we have and piecing together what happened. Guys, did you... and forgive me for not remembering if the episode addresses this. Did you make efforts to reach out to Jose Gonzalez or Carlos Colon?
For Carlos Colon, yes. Dating all the way back to the very beginning, when we were, I probably talked to Dutch Mantel and Tony Atlas and all those guys, I don't know, 6 months before we ever got like the money in to make the show. So I had them sort of, like I was saying earlier, like, you know, teed up to do this. And Carlos was the same. I had talked to Carlos many times on the phone about being a part of the project and, you know, of course, had to be transparent about what we were, you know, focusing on. And he was just super hesitant to get into it, didn't want to relive it. It's not a pretty story. It's not a happy story, you know, type thing, and ultimately declined. And then Jose Gonzalez, we didn't try getting until we were in production on season one. And we had a security guard.
Oh, yeah.
That worked in the office who spoke Spanish, and he helped us with the phone call to Jose. And it was very evident that the first few times that I reached out, or that we reached out, you know, with the security guard to Jose, that, you know, he pretended he was not Jose, you know, somebody else. That's that whole thing, kind of ducking the call. And then finally, he did verbally pass, you know, on the episode. And there wasn't much more beyond that, but we definitely made repeated attempts to get his comment in the show.
We mentioned the history of some ill will, perhaps, between Jose Gonzalez and Bruiser Brody prior to this incident. Interestingly enough, as Tony Atlas told you guys, there was also some ill will between himself, Tony Atlas, and Bruiser Brody before this incident happened. And in fact, they just sort of had patched things up shortly before the tragic day in question. He explained to you guys that there had been tension around Brody being the booker in Dallas for World Class, which he was for a little while, big star down there. And Tony Atlas recalls showing up to the building one time, being told he was booked. But to hear Tony tell it, you know, Kerry Von Erich was coming back off of his accident where he lost the tip of his foot. And the word in the locker room, according to Tony Atlas, was that Fritz Von Erich didn't want guys with the kind of musculature that Tony Atlas had to be in the territory. Ultimate Warrior was also there at the time as the Dingo Warrior, another guy that was thought to perhaps take the shine out of the central characteristic of Kerry Von Erich if they were around. So they were getting kind of dicked around to hear Tony tell the story. And so he's told he's booked at this building and he shows up only to be told by one of Brody's emissaries that he was in fact not booked. And I don't know why you're here. I don't know what the confusion was. I'm really sorry. And, you know, again, in a glimpse of how the rage can come out of Tony Atlas as he tells the story of how he pretty much freaked out at this turn of events, blamed Brody, was mad at Brody, was ready to, in fact, fight Brody, and how actually this incident led to him pursuing a career in Puerto Rico and leaving Dallas.
I said, what do you mean I'm not booked? I said, I drove all the way here. And now y'all guys tell me you're not booked. Let me talk to Brody. He said, no, well, he's busy. But I said, fuck that. Just let me talk to him. I'm going to talk to him. So I went outside, and they told me I got to leave the building and all this, that stuff. I get angry. So I'm trying to get Brody or Eric Embry or somebody related to the office. I didn't care who it was to come out in the parking lot to fight me. Finally, the security police came around and told me I had to leave the building. Otherwise, they're going to arrest me. So I went back to my hotel, and me and the warrior, we stay in the same complex. So I went to his room and told him what happened. He said, I knew they're going to jerk you around. He said, I got the same phone call. He said, I didn't go. He said, I don't trust him. He said, I ain't worrying about it anyway. He said, I'm going to, I talked to Vince, and McMahon, this is what the Warrior told me. He said, McMahon told me if I give up going to Japan, because he had a good deal in Japan. Mm-hmm. He said, if I give him my Japan deal, then he was going to let me come to New York. So he got I'm gonna get a good star there. So I said, well, good for you, brother. I said, he said, you want me to put in work for you? I said, oh, don't mention my name. I got heat with the office. And he said, well, you better start looking for a place to go, Tony. They're not gonna book you. He said, they're not gonna book you no more. So I called Carlos Colon. Carlos said, oh, great kid, love to have you. So then I left and went to Puerto Rico.
So that's kind of how it started, was the enmity with Bruiser Brody. Tony Atlas gets the relationship going in Puerto Rico. We know from the gunslinging story before why he may have had heat in New York and wouldn't necessarily have felt welcome in that locker room. So fast forward all the way to 1988 and the day that Brody was killed, or the week he was killed. Tony Atlas recalls working out in the gym and seeing Brody there, and they kind of squashed the beef there. And here in this clip, Tony explains how Brody sort of accounted for why there was such a disagreement and tension between the two back in the World Class days, and kind of owns up to some things that Tony kind of says, you know, kind of forgives him for, but he does apologize. And they're going on. And Tony, in having this conversation with Brody, hears Brody say that, you know, there's going to be some changes around here. You know, like, you want to stick around. I'm glad to have you on my side. There's going to be some changes here in Puerto Rico. And the exact phraseology Tony Atlas recalls is Bruiser Brody saying, I waited a long time to, quote, get in down here. And to Tony Atlas, get in means that Bruiser Brody has purchased an interest in the territory and is now a shot caller in Puerto Rico in this wrestling office, not just a wrestler, but somebody who now has a stake. And Tony Atlas was not shy in talking to you guys about tying that fact and his inference by what Bruiser Brody meant about getting in down here to his demise.
I thought he was going to fire Jose. That's what I think. And Jose probably walked him in that shower and said, I hear you're going to fire me. And Brody said, yeah, I'm going to fire you. And he put the blade to him. That's what I think. Because when you buy in, you're not the booker. You're not an employee no more. He had just the only person in at that when Brody died, the only person that had more power than Brody in that place was Carlos. Brody was a number two man.
Guys, it must have been so hard to, you know, piece through all the suppositions about what could have caused this. You know, everyone has a different version of the story, but there, Tony's admitting his.
I do remember that when the episode dropped and a lot of the people who were experts on the story or scholars on this incident, a lot of them weighed in and were very dubious of Tony's claim that Brody was buying into the territory. So it was tough to really say. And it was obviously something that, you know, people usually also pointed to the fact that, well, Barbara must have known if he was buying into the territory, but you don't know that for sure. You know, you don't know, you know, wrestlers do also kayfabe their partners a lot of the time from a lot of the stuff that's going on in the biz. And that might've just well been one thing that he did, you know, with Barbara. But we'll never know.
I find it interesting too. Like even like, you know, after we've done the episode, like new information will like trigger, like trickle out, or like wrestlers will admit to things that they didn't admit to before.
Carlos Colon had a stronghold, you know, in the territory, and a lot of people were probably afraid of their jobs and saying, you know, what they really saw. And speaking of the court trial itself, I'll also never forget one of the cruel things of, you know, how timing works sometimes when we're putting this episode together, we're locking it, sending it off to the network, and it's done, you know, goodbye, it's over. And then like a week later, someone uploads the footage of the court trial like on YouTube. We're like, fuck.
Yeah, well covered by the Puerto Rican media was this whole episode and the trial, as you said. Definitely not something that was, you know, hidden from public view.
That's another thing, too. I remember when we were working on the episode, we did dig through all the newspaper archives in Puerto Rico and getting like microfilm sent up, you know, things that we were able to had the luxury of spending time on when you're just focusing on one episode instead of 14 or 10 or 20 this time around. It was 20 at the same time. But anyway, so we got the newspaper microfiche sent up and it was translated. And I remember reading through those and just being my mind blown by details that I'd never heard before. Like there was a toxicology report that was done on Brody and like to find, you know, it was no secret now that, you know, Brody liked to smoke of the gunge, you know, and just the fact that he was like fully stoned during that experience of his final moments is very terrifying to me to imagine that.
As mentioned, Brody was sort of waiting for his ride. And what happened was Tony gave him a ride. He saw him sitting there waiting for a ride and said, yeah, I'm going with this guy from a gym that I just met and he's going to come to the matches. We're going to get him in. Why don't you come with us? So they get to the building and the incident happens. And one of the things that Tony remembered was that while Brody was being loaded into the ambulance and Tony was the only guy to really put his hand up to hear him say it, to go with Brody to the hospital and actually leave the arena, he realizes that he doesn't speak Spanish. And the paramedics, of course, all are Spanish speaking. Everybody around him is Spanish speaking. He needs a translator, but nobody's coming with him. And it's at this point he grabs a translator.
I grabbed him by the belt. You know how you give somebody a Reggie when you pull up on his belt? Well, I curl him. And as the ambulance is pulling out, I'm holding him just like this because he's trying to get loose. You see what I'm saying? He's dangling in the air, brother. And I'm holding on with one hand and holding him with the other hand. That's how I got him to the hospital with me. And he calmed down once he got out of the building. That when he said, okay, brother, you can put me down. He said, but he, you know, he didn't want to go. He was scared to death. Later, I wish I hadn't took him because he ended up getting shot for going with me. They shot him 5 times in the back.
Do they know who shot him?
All I found out that he got shot. ended up in a wheelchair. He's in a wheelchair. He's probably dead now.
He takes a guess in the interview, if you read the transcript of who it was. He gets it wrong, I think, because he's talking about Miguel Perez, and it wasn't Miguel Perez. I think who he's referring to is Pedro Huracan Castillo, who is the father of Jesus Castillo Jr., who was Jesus in the Los Pericuas faction that WWF had in the gang wars in 97. Don't have access to the microfiche like you guys did to the Puerto Rican media, but there are traces online of reports that Huracan Castillo was shot and confined to a wheelchair as a result of being shot and passed away in 1993. So that's got to be who he's talking about and remembering.
Wow. Yeah, I missed that. Yeah, there's a lot of in this story, in the chaos of what's happening, you know, as this Brody saga is unfolding. There's a lot of, you know, Tony panic involves grabbing people and grabbing them by parts of their body and bringing them from point A to point B, you know, and it's, you know, he's trying to do his best, but I'm sure he's also, you know, giving.
Nobody wants anything to do with it. Nobody wants to bear witness to it unfolding at the hospital or anything, especially somebody who speaks Spanish and obviously had a deep connection to the power structure in Puerto Rican wrestling. Now, who's to say that, you know, Tony is on the mark as to why this wrestler was shot, who, you know, need to make that proviso. But at the same time, he's left to wonder about these little strings that you can pull. Like you said, there's a million of them in this story. What happened there? So Brody's stabbed. He's on his way to the hospital. And Tony Atlas is in the ambulance with him, trying to console him. And you guys captured a sweet moment where Tony Atlas tries to comfort Brody in a way that ends up rather comedic and definitely not the emotion you'd expect for such a tense situation. Listen to this.
Yeah, I sung to him. I sung him a song, If Heaven Ain't a Lot, Like Dick Said, I Don't Want to Go. And he kind of gave me a little bit of smile, kind of like, Tony, don't quit your day job, smile. You know, it was like, oh, my God, Tony, you're killing the song. You know, he loved that song, but me singing it didn't sound like, you know, George Jones singing it. So that kind of gave him a little bit of a humor there. He kind of laughed at me singing. He thought my singing was funny. So he laughed a little bit, which made me feel good that through, you know, with 2 8-inch cuts and his intestine hanging out, his liver cut into, that I could make him laugh. Not laugh out loud, but just smile, you know. It was like, please, Tony, I'm hurt enough. Don't sing no more.
he details in the episode, you know, just the chaos of being in the emergency room. And eventually, despite having to physically grab a doctor to attend to Brody, bring him to the front of the line of all the stabbing victims that Tony Atlas remembers being in that Puerto Rican hospital at that moment. And the medical staff kind of being dismissive that this guy's stab wound is any much worse than people who were here before him.
Well, did they know he was a wrestler?
The doctors?
Yeah.
I don't recall if Atlas specified that.
I wonder if they thought it was a fake wound.
The police certainly thought so, right, guys?
They did.
The police thought it was them trying to pull some stunt, you know, to get publicity or, you know, whatever.
They didn't show up with a ton of urgency. I mean, the wrestlers talk about it as if the paramedics get there and are like, holy shit, like, wait a minute, this guy's really,
yeah,
you know what I mean?
It's exactly what I was talking about, you know, when you're converging, you know, this, you know, fantasy world with immediate time sensitive, you know, situation, like, what's happening here?
And JP, Bruiser Brody with such a caveman visage, you know, he cut such a jib, terrifying looking guy, nice enough guy to people he liked, but to think of him in that ambulance, you know, cracking a smile at how badly Tony Atlas is singing. That's what an image.
I can imagine that was like a wonderful final little memory for him, you know, cracking a joke at fucking Tony Atlas and his awful singing.
In the episode, we show Tony singing him the song in the ambulance, but it's not, I don't really remember that we included the part where, you know, his singing was so poor that it made Brody smile, which is kind of a
right,
nice.
Yeah. It comes off like he was just soothing him.
Right. Right. Yeah. It's kind of a nice moment there, you know, between them.
Brody still had it in him to crack a joke at Tony Atlas.
Right. Like,
expense.
Jesus Christ, can you spare me here?
So after the stabbing, Tony goes back to the arena, and then he ends up going back to the hotel, but only briefly, if I'm following what he's saying correctly, because he basically got the vibe that it's not safe to go back to the hotel where he could be found, okay, where people expected him to be. And on the way back from this crazy panicked situation, someone had told him that I can hear your heart beating out of your chest, Tony, you know, you must be a wreck. I can hear your heart beating. And that messed with his head a bit because he, you know, he doesn't want to have a heart attack or a stroke because of all the stress of this situation. So he's trying to find a way to like purposefully calm down and cool down to the best degree he can. Yet he can't, you know, go back to his hotel room because he's scared. And he ends up doing what the guys looked forward to the most when they went to Puerto Rico. But for the darkest of reasons, he sought the comfort of the ocean.
What I was trying to do, instead of think about what happened to Brody, to be honest with you, I was trying to not think about what happened to Brody. Same. So that I don't have a stroke or a heart attack. A guy just told me, I could hear your heart beating.
So you laid on the beach and just like fell asleep?
No, didn't fall asleep.
Oh, you didn't?
No, I just kept walking the beach the whole night. I never slept. I walked up and down the beach all night.
We were going to include that. I remember like we had plans to shoot recreate. Well,
he says that in the episode. He says I walked the beach the whole night, but it doesn't get into the detail. We didn't have the room for the detail, but I remember during that interview, during that moment of being like, oh, yep, clocking that. That's going to be, you know, a scene because it's so cinematic. You know, and it's interesting to kind of bring this full circle, and I don't mean to be cheeky about this, but, you know, seeing my own two eyes, seeing Tony, you know, in his, you know, most heightened state, shall we say, you can vividly picture what it must have been like, you know. I could totally see what it was like when he gets set off.
A ball of nerves ready to explode.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And it must have been terrifying for anybody who was there.
He flies out. He got the news, you know, that Brody had actually passed away, and he tells all that in gripping detail in the episode. But he eventually gets the hell out of Puerto Rico. And to sort of wrap it up here on Dark Side of the Ring Unheard, a very strange moment, befitting the strangeness and the eeriness of the whole matter, I suppose. One last time, Tony Atlas remembers. Only one more time in his life and career did he run into Bruiser Brody's killer. And here's how he remembers it.
Did you ever see Jose again?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
What did you say to him?
Nothing. He came up to me because I went back for Carlos. This was like years back, and he was there. And he came up to me and just shook my hand and walked away. I remember Barry Windham was there. Barry Windham, Black Jack Mulligan's son. He said, that was fucking weird. Yeah, that was it. I saw him one time after that.
Jason and Evan, it's quite a story, and it gets more eerie the more you find out. And as Jason said, the years turn, more comes out about it. This was such a personal thing for you. Recording Tony Atlas was trying in and of itself, as you guys have explained, but hearing him tell it back, just final thoughts on Tony Atlas opening himself up for you guys on season one.
Just as you said, as difficult as it was, as uphill of a climb it was, and there definitely was a long period of time where I felt that this show was never going to happen, you know, even before all of this, there was many times of that. There was many, you know, it took a lot to get this show off the ground and to get made. And there's a lot of challenges and, you know, circumventing, like Jason was saying, people who were dubious of it or money not being available. And then once you finally get that and you get onto the field and then you have a crisis on your hands, you know, that's just hard to control, elements beyond your control. And, you know, this show might not have ever happened. So thankfully, you know, even to Tony's credit, he was able to come back around again and trust us. And we were able to do it, you know, and we were able to make it work. And, you know, so we do owe a lot to him for that.
Yeah.
Because he is the main character of that episode in a lot of ways. There might not even be a show, or I mean, there definitely wouldn't be a show without Tony.
Yeah, he deserves a lot of credit like that. I remember like when we would show that pilot episode to people, they were like so engaged by his story and thought it was so powerful. And I think it was like the best example, like even though at the time we thought that this episode could be it. But I really do think like because of Tony, it like helped us, you know, to show that there can be other stories and other storytellers like him. But he is definitely exceptional. And it's interesting too, like with the recent WWE merger with Netflix and their like $5 billion deal, I've seen The Rock on a stock market show. And he gave credit to his father, Rocky Johnson, and Tony Atlas for paving the way. And he like thought, you know, that they wouldn't be there. The company wouldn't be where it's at if it wasn't for him. And so it's amazing, you know, that all of this, you know, is, you know, partly because of Tony as well, too. And he, you know, he does deserve that credit. And I think that's pretty cool. Another thing, too, got to give a shout out to our friend Emerson Murray, who wrote about Bruiser Brody. And I was trying to remember, wasn't there like some detail, too, where he had tried to contact
yes.
the Puerto Rican government and they like.
He tried to get the court transcripts from the court case, and his girlfriend or his wife at the time or his partner called the law offices or whoever you would call for such a thing, and she spoke Spanish and was talking to her on the phone, and she's like, okay, call back here, you know, at such and such time. I'm going to go down and check, you know, the files and see if they're there, so on and so forth. And then they called back, and then I guess the person in the courts or whatever was like, I just looked and they're not there, and don't ever call back here ever again. And it was like some ominous, you know, phone call. And one other thing too, just on closing for me is like, you know, after hearing that last little exchange that Tony had with Jose, it does speak to kind of the banality of evil in a lot of ways. And I do remember learning that when we were finishing the episode, like, you know, trying to contact Jose Gonzalez and going on his Facebook page and seeing that he's, you know, wearing that fucking mask, you know, and posing with little children, doing birthday parties, you know, blowing out candles with children. And it's just like, wow, dude, it's just like, that's the dark side of the ring right there.
So we do thank you for joining us for this look at some of the other insights that Tony Atlas offered dark side cameras at an absolutely critical point for the series, which very much continues in stride, coming up Tuesday night, 10 p.m. Eastern on Vice TV, a look at the life and the demise of Gentleman Chris Adams, coming your way on Dark Side of the Ring. But for now and for us, it's back to the vault. So we'll see you next time on Dark Side of the Ring, Unheard.